it is a remarkable book, and I'm as a librarian, I'm a little embarrassed to admit that that lately I have not had the attention span to read books that are longer than 150 pages. So if you need books that are 150 pages, I have a lot of recommendations. However, this was the one book that I did read that was more than 150 pages. I devoured it. I loved this book. The Shadow King, it's an exceptionally powerful story. It casts a light on the women soldiers during World War II, during Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia. The story itself is really captivating, but it's the writing that pulls you in. And there are people that can say this far better than me. I think a critic in NPR said it best. The star of the novel, however, is Mengistu's gorgeous writing, which makes The Shadow King nearly impossible to put down. One of the most beautiful novels of the year, and that really is true. It is a gorgeously written book. The New York Times exalted that the book is lyrical, remarkable, breathtakingly skillful. The reader feels in the steady hands of a master. The Wall Street Journal called it stirring. Mazen Mengistu was born in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. She is the author of the novel Beneath the Lion's Gaze, which was selected by The Guardian as one of the 10 best contemporary African books and named one of the best books of 2010 by the Christian Science Monitor, the Boston Globe, and other publications, multiple places. She is the recipient of fellowships from the Fulbright Scholar Program, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Creative Capital. Her work can be found in The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, Granta, The Guardian, The New York Times, Rolling Stone, and BBC, among other places. Maz's fiction and nonfiction examines the individual lives at stake during migration, war, and exile, and considers the intersections of photography, memory, and violence. She was a writer on the documentary projects Girl Rising and The Invisible City, Kakuma. She's also a great follow on Twitter, if you're on Twitter. I love her pictures of Ethiopian beetles. They're fantastic. And so welcome, Maza.
Thank you. Thank you. It is really a pleasure to be here and to see familiar faces and familiar faces because I know where you're from. I have written many, many pages and chapters of The Shadow King in this library. It is, I call it my library, even though I know it's not just mine. I have some secret places in the alcoves where I would go and write in complete silence and privacy. So I love this place and thank you for inviting me. I'm going to give you a bit of a background on my, I guess, how I became inspired by this story of Ethiopia from 1935 to 41, and go through a little bit of that, and then I will read a bit from the book, and then I hope that this leaves enough room and stirs your imagination, and you can ask me some questions, and I'll explain some more. But this story of Ethiopia defeating Italy, Ethiopia kicking out the Italians, Mussolini, who came in an attempt to colonize the country, was a story that I grew up with as a child in Ethiopia. I left when I was quite young during the early days of a revolution that began in 1974. But before that, before I left, I remember these stories from my grandfather. I remembered these stories from my parents, from my aunts. People would come into our house at different gatherings, and there was often somebody would talk about what one of their relatives did during this war. It was part of my imagination. It became part of my sense of who I was and the kind of country Ethiopia was. What I heard were stories of one of the most technologically advanced militaries in Europe, Italy, which was true at the time, invading Ethiopia, and Ethiopians whom, if they were lucky to have weapons, they were 40 or 50 years old. And these were weapons from the first confrontation with Italy in the late 1890s. People, families kept their guns. They were using them mainly for guarding livestock. And here comes Italy getting ready to invade. And people mobilized across Ethiopia, brought their guns if they had them, brought their spears, brought, what else, swords, and started fighting this war that they did not start. And it was a brutal war. But after 5 years, Ethiopia won. And it was really a story of David against Goliath. And David won. I can't tell you the kind of pride that gives a child and that gives a community. And it creates a sense of identity for Ethiopians. I have still, even still, coming to the U.S., gathered around Ethiopians, gathered around my family, we will start with these stories. And for me, it became mythic and legend, these heroes of the culture. So when I was thinking about writing my book, I knew I wanted to write a book that would become Beneath the Lion's Gaze, which is set in 1974. Initially, I thought, you know, I really would like to tell this story of the Italian invasion of Ethiopia. I really want to tell this story. I'd had this story in my head for so long, but I understood right away that this was a history that was so large and that would require so much research. There was so much I did not know about this that I needed to write a book first, another book, to understand what it means to write. How do I research? I didn't know any of it. I said, let me just write one book. Let me see how this thing works. And then let me start this research for the shadow, what would become the Shadow King, as I'm writing Beneath the Lion's Gaze. So I started writing Beneath the Lion's Gaze, and I started at that point taking Italian classes so that I could prepare myself to do the research of the Shadow King in archives that I assumed, that I knew would be Italian. I finished the book, Beneath the Lion's Gaze. I was very lucky to win a fellowship that allowed me to move to Italy, and I did research in the fascist archives for about a year. But a funny thing happened while I was doing that. I was researching in the libraries. I was listening to Mussolini's speeches. I was looking at recordings that they made in Ethiopia, in Eritrea, in Somalia, also in Libya. And something, it struck me at some point that all of the accounts that I was listening to, all of the newspaper accounts I was reading, all those, these old documents had been censored in 1935 to 1941. These were documents that had been approved by the fascist regime. And I wasn't quite sure how to move around that to get this side of the war. I had my family side. I had these stories that I had been growing up with. But I wanted to understand what was going on from the Italian perspective. What was really happening? I know that the war lasted 5 years, but the stories I got from home were stories of victory and battle, and maybe they were a few days here and there, but this thing was for 5 years. What did people do every single day for those 5 years? What was that? What was war like? But the archives were giving me something else that just felt very controlled and very clearly Italian, pro-fascist. I wasn't sure what to do about that. And I started talking to friends of mine who are Italian. And I would ask them, do you have relatives that fought in Ethiopia, that were in Eritrea? Can you tell me anything about your relatives' experiences? They said, oh, I don't know, let me check. They would go and check, and almost every single one came back to me and said, I didn't know my uncle was in the war. I didn't realize that this was happening. And then they would say, we asked, I asked, but I have discovered that Ethiopia is a wall in our family. We do not talk about it. My mother didn't want to talk about it. My grandfather didn't want to talk. My grandmother refuses to give me information. Ethiopia is a wall. And that was my first clue that, if there is there's something more here. You know, for a novelist, I said, what is it that people cannot really talk about? What is it that I couldn't find in the archives? I'm not learning from Ethiopian, from my family necessarily. What is that thing these men brought home and then refused to speak about? And my real breakthrough came at one point. I was on tour in Italy for my first book, Beneath the Lion's Gaze, and I was in the southern part of Italy in Catania. And what I understood of the military in Italy is that most of the officers came from the north. The north was more industrial, had more money, people were better educated. They were the officers. The foot soldiers, the people that were really on the ground fighting, came from the south of Italy. It was divided by class, the same way that the military is often divided, even here. So I was in Catania in the south, and I said, I know the war in Ethiopia was fought by these people. I wondered what I would find. I was in the library, and there were a small library in this very small town, and I had talked about the book, and it was time for question and answer, and a man stood up, and even when he stood up, I could tell he was emotional. And in my head, I said, oh, here we go. Here, it's about to start. And he said, I want to talk about 1935. And the entire room, and they were all Italians, immediately tensed. I could feel the room get stiff. And there were some people that turned and were just not happy with him, wanted him to sit down. He didn't listen to them. And he started shaking. And he started crying, and he said, my father was one of the pilots that dropped the poison gas on your people. How do I apologize to you for what my country has done, for what my father has done? At this point, he was really crying. He said, how do we apologize to Ethiopia? And I the room was shocked, silent, and I wasn't quite sure what to say. And I said, you know, we need to have these conversations. This is a start. Thank you. He said, please don't leave. Please don't leave. I will be right back. So I stayed until he came back. And when he came back, he had copies of his father's letters, pages from his journals. While he was a pilot in Ethiopia, he had copies of photographs, and he said, take it and do with it whatever you want. I took it back with me to my apartment in Rome and started going through this work, and his father was honest about what he did, about the bombs and the jokes they made as they were dropping them and the photographs, and I realized, oh my gosh, this is what I've been looking for. These are the personal histories that were not censored by the fascist censors. These were letters or journals that these men carried back with them that weren't checked. They took photographs, and those photographs, if they kept them in a roll and didn't develop them, they could develop them later. This was an uncensored history. And that was really when this book began. And what I did, I left the archives completely. And I decided I was going to travel across Italy by train, by bus, by foot, whatever I needed to do. And I started going to flea markets. And I would go into these small towns, or I would go into these larger towns, and there was always a fascist table. There was always, 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 always. And there was, and I would, there I am, and I would go right there. And I would start talking to the vendors if they allowed me to talk to them. Sometimes they were so visibly upset because I'm Ethiopian and they recognized me that they would push me or just try to get me away from the table. In those instances, I would bring an Italian friend. And then I would tell the friend, go get this and this and this, please, for me. So I usually went with someone. But I would go to these places, and I got to know some of the vendors really well. And I had my fellowship money, and these vendors took all my money. They took most of it. I started buying photographs that I found. And at some point, I had a vendor, he took most of my money. And he would tell me, come back in a week, come back in 2 weeks. I'm going to have something soon, I think. And I started asking him, how do you have this? What's happening here with these photographs and these albums? And he said, these men are dying, and their families don't want this reminder of the war anymore. And so they give them to me, and then I sell them, and you know, here I come. This is really where the where my story began. Let me see if this works. Okay. Yes. So this is one of the photographs, one of the early photographs that gave me a sense of these men took their cameras to war. Can everybody see this from here? That these men were bringing their cameras to war. They were photographing each other, but they were also photographing Ethiopians. They were photographing their lives in those years that they were there. And what I understood about the camera at that point in Mussolini's time is that Mussolini was well aware that that photography could be another weapon in war, that it was a weapon for him. So before the war started, there were already people in Ethiopia, in Eritrea, in Somalia, taking photographs, trying to depict people who were so primitive and uncivilized that actually the Italians were being kind in wanting to civilize them and come into their country. The camera was a weapon, and Mussolini was well aware that he needed to galvanize public support, and the photograph was one of the ways that he did it. And here are these officers in Ethiopia. I believe this is somewhere, I have some information on some of them. I think this is Harar, right around there. One of my characters is a photographer, an Italian photographer by the name of Ettore. And it was in seeing this image in particular, when I first got it, this photo in Rome, I began to understand that when these men were photographing Ethiopians or East Africans, they were, the image, number one, was very controlled. There was a way that they wanted to depict themselves, and there's a way that they wanted to depict the Ethiopians or the East Africans. But the fact that there's a shadow here was for me a clue that someone's controlling this image. This is not a natural pose for this man here, the Ethiopian. He's probably scared. I don't know what happened before or after this image, but this is supposed to represent not the East African, not this man. This man has not much to do with it. This is a way that this man might want to remember himself once he goes home. The violence is out until you see the photographer there and you realize maybe this man didn't, the Ethiopian did not want to take this photograph. What happened to him after? Was he a prisoner? What was going on here? And as I kept looking at this picture and staring at it, I started understanding all of these images were crafted to re-remember history in a certain way, to retell or reshape memories. And when I think about the title of my book, The Shadow King, there are many reasons I chose that title, but one of the reasons I did was the Shadow King is a photographer who works with shadows, who works with light, who dominates this space that's also dark. This is another one this is Shano. I'm Marcato. I'm doing more research on these images. This is 1936. And again, when I look at this, it's not a simple picture. The thing that my eye keeps gravitating towards here is the way that this woman's face is revealed because there's someone pulling her hat back. And I assume that I'm thinking she wanted it down. She didn't want this picture. But this man has lifted that hat up a little bit, and the Italians are laughing, but no one else is. And she looks distraught. I'm going to pause here. I'll go through. Let me just go through. And this is the place I'll stop for right now. I have a couple more photos. But I came across this image, and I knew that I had a character named Hirut in my book. And the minute I saw this, I said, oh, I found her. I have found her. So she's in the back of the book. But as I was doing this research, and I was looking through these letters and albums and journals, I started finding one or two lines here and there of a woman with a gun, a woman with a rifle. And then I found a photograph of a woman in a long dress with a rifle. And once I did that, I said, wait a minute. What's happening here? I knew that women followed men behind the men in war in Ethiopia to collect the dead, take care of the wounded, bring the food, get the water, do all these things. But I'm seeing women in a bit of a different role. And then I found a headline in the New York Times, and it was November 4th, 1935, of a man in the Ethiopian army who is killed in battle, and his wife runs and gets his rifle and leads 2,000 of his men to victory. And then I find another headline from September 1935 when Haile Selassie has a mobilization call and a legion of women enlist in the army. And I said, oh, this is a story. This is a story that I really want to tell about these women who fought and were often, I never heard about them. So I started writing this book from the perspective of these women, from the perspective of a young girl named Hirut, who follows her household. She's a maid for a nobleman who is an officer in an army, and his wife, she's their maid. And when Kidane says, we need to go, we need to move, we're mobilizing, the war is starting, Hirut and Aster gather the women from the neighborhood, from the area, and follow the men. But at some point, Aster starts thinking, why can't I fight like a man? If Empress Taitu did it the first time in the confrontation with Italy 40 years before, we had an empress who led men, who led in the army. Why can't I do it? Kidane and his wife, they don't get along. And if you don't get along before a war, you're not going to get along during a war. They don't get along, and he says, leave me alone, leave me alone, leave this alone. You will listen to what I say, and you'll help my men. But she has other ideas, and Hirut eventually joins her to become a soldier in the army with Kidane. I'm going to read from the very opening of this book. The book opens in 1974. 40 years after the war, Hirut now is an older woman, thinking back to her days as a soldier in 1935. So I'll read a very small section, and then I will show you a few more pictures, and then we'll open it up for some questions, and I can keep talking. So this is from the very beginning of the book. The soldier, hopefully, maybe this will... If it's not here in this part, she's come to meet an Italian soldier from 40 years ago. His name is Ettore. This is 1974. Ettore was a photographer. She does not want to remember, but she is here, and memory is gathering bones. She has come by foot and by bus to Addis Ababa, across terrain she has chosen to forget for nearly 40 years. She is 2 days early, but she will wait for him, seated on the ground in this corner of the train station, the metal box on her lap, her back pressed against the wall, rigid as a sentinel. She has put on the dress she does not wear every day. Her hair is neatly braided and sleek, and she has been careful to hide the long scar that puckers at the base of her neck and trails over her shoulder like a broken necklace. In the box are his letters. Le lettere. Ho sepolto le mie lettere, e il mio segreto, Hirut, anche il tuo segreto. Segreto, secret, mister. You must keep them for me until I see you again. Now go, vattene. Hurry before they catch you. There are newspaper clippings with dates spanning the course of the war between her country and his. She knows he has arranged them from the start, 1935, to nearly the end, 1941. In the box are photographs of her, those he took on Fucelli's orders and labeled in his own neat handwriting. Una bella ragazza, una soldata feroce, and those he took of his own free will. Memento scavenged from the life of the frightened young woman she was in that prison, behind that barbed wire fence, trapped in terrifying nights that she could not free herself from. Inside the box are the many dead that insist on resurrection. She has traveled for 5 days to get to this place. She has pushed her way through checkpoints and nervous soldiers, past frightened villagers whispering of a coming revolution and violent student protests. She has watched while a parade of young women raising fists and rifles marched past the bus taking her to Bahardar. They stared at her, an aging woman in her long drab dress, as if they did not know those who came before them, as if this were the first time a woman carried a gun, as if the ground beneath their feet had not been won by some of the greatest fighters Ethiopia has ever known, women named Aster, Nardos, Abebech, Sadala, Aziza, Hanna, Maaza, Ainadis, Dabru, Yodit, Ililta, Ababa, Kedist, Balinesh, Maskaram, Nunu, Tigist, Sahai, Beza, Saba, and a woman simply called the cook. Hirut murmured the names of those women as the students marched past, each utterance hurling her back in time until she was once again on ragged terrain, choking in fumes and gunpowder, suffocating in the pungent stench of poison. She was brought back to the bus, to the present, only after one old man grabbed her by the arm as he took a seat next to her. If Mussolini couldn't get rid of the emperor, what do these students think they are doing now? Hirut shook her head then. She shakes her head now. She has come this far to return this box, to rid herself of the horrors that stagger back unbidden. She has come to give up the ghosts and drive them away. She has no time for questions. She has no time to correct an old man's pronunciation. One name always drags with it another. Nothing travels alone. And I'll stop there with that. And I will show you a couple more photographs. I think I have them. This is one of the images that really, for me, solidified this history and this story. This was taken, I've heard different accounts, either 1935 or 1941, just at the end of the war, but this is one of the women who enlisted and who fought. After I had found this, after I had been writing this story for a number of years, after I had been going to Ethiopia to do more research, I was talking to my mother about this photograph and about some of the other photographs and headlines that I had been finding about the women. And in the midst of this conversation, my mother stopped me and she said, "Well, don't you know about your great-grandmother?" And I, you know, the first time she said it, I think my brain just couldn't, I couldn't hear her. I said, "What did you say?" And she said, "Well, your great-grandmother, Etete, she was in the war." And I said, "Wait a minute, wait, okay. What, and I said, "You've been with me for how many years in this thing? You've heard me talk about this research and the women." She said, "Well, you never asked." So I said, "Please tell me the story. Please tell me." So we stayed up all night, and the story of my great-grandmother, Gete, she was married at a very young age to a man who was older than her. She was too young at that point to be a wife. She could not live with this adult man. So she lived still with her father and her three brothers. Her mother had passed away. When the mobilization call came across the country, the eldest of every family, "Bring your gun if you have it. Bring your sword, bring your spear. We need to, the war is coming. Go to the front lines." My great-grandmother wanted to go. And her father said, "You're way too young. You're much too young. I'm going to give my gun to your husband, and he will represent our family and go." And she said, "No, he won't. I'm the eldest." She didn't like her husband. Eventually, she would leave him at some point, but she didn't like him. And she said, "He will not have that gun. That's mine, and I will go." When her father refused, she went in front of the judges, the village judges, and pled her case. And she won. And she got her father's gun, and she went to the front lines. I didn't know this story until so many years after. And I'm still surprised that I didn't know this. But I have a sense now that I've been thinking about the way that the Italians have the wall that is Ethiopia. I think that women have stories in Ethiopia that are shared by women in the kitchen, in the spaces where women gather. And those, there are certain stories that never leave the company of women. And I think my great-grandmother's story was one of those. And I think that because I had met her before she died, and I knew of her as a strong woman, very, very opinionated, quite short. But I had none of this. And sometimes, now I'm thinking maybe there are, histories are also, women talk about stories, but they are history, and we don't always hear them because they happen in the spaces where women talk. So I'm very interested in these, and I've been telling all my friends, please go ask your family, what didn't they tell you? You didn't know to ask. What are these other stories? And so my great-grandmother is one of those. And once I found out her story, I started understanding. There are headlines, but this story is also part of my blood. It's also my family story. Oh, and that's it. Okay, that's the end of that. So I will end there. I want to open it up for questions, but what let me tell you one more thing. I am starting a photo archive. I'm creating a site, and I'm asking people with family photographs that relate to this time, 1935 to 1941, connected to the Italian-Ethiopian War, please contact me. My email address is really easy. It's maazamengiste.com. It's really easy. So I've been putting this call out, and it's been really interesting to me to have people come to tell me. A young woman said, "I had no idea my grandmother was in the war. I have a photograph of her from the 70s, but I'm getting I have a recording of her singing some of the war songs. So I'm digitizing that to put up there. But I had a really interesting thing, and I'm asking all the Abhisha in here, please check with your families if you have them so that this history is not silent. But I had an interesting experience recently. I put this call out on social media, and an Italian man emailed me, and he said, "Is this only for Ethiopians and East Africans?" And I said, "Actually, it's not, now that I think about it." And I said, "Do you have something?" And he said, "My grandfather was a soldier in this war, but I have two questions for you. Will you accept my photographs of him? But my second request is, my grandfather had a child with an Ethiopian woman, my uncle, and my family is refusing to give me information to help me find him. Will you help me?" So I said, "Please send me your photographs. This is also our history." And I said, "I don't know if I can help you, but let me check." So I called my mother, and I said, "There's an Italian man. He's looking for his uncle." He said, "Just give me the information. I'll find him." So we are looking, but anyone with this connection to this history, this is, I think, a way to begin a dialogue. Like that man, I will never forget, in Catania, who said, how can you forgive us? I think this is a step to learn this history. So I will leave it at that. But thank you, everyone. And I'm happy to answer questions now. Yes.
Hi, my name is Diego Sebastian. I'm a younger guy, man myself. And you're right, I actually know very little about the Ethiopian Italian War. Just also because on my side of the family, center left is my great. I know only that my great grandfather was actually purged by the fascists.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I know about some Italian movies depicting those years, and I never watched them because frankly I don't think they're any good. But my question is, have you seen them?
Which ones? The ones during the fascist period?
That was the famous, yeah, during the fascist period.
No. I mean, I've seen a lot. These were propaganda films. And they were crafted to continue support for what was happening in Ethiopia, but also to camouflage the level of violence and brutality that was there. And it was really to depict and to create a symbol of what a fascist family or woman or man, you know, should be doing and thinking. I've seen them, and it was years ago. But if there is a film that you're wondering about to watch, you know, in the current time, there is a very good documentary that screened here a few times in New York. It's made by two young Italians called "If Only I Were That Warrior." And it's a fantastic documentary. I'm waiting for the film by an Ethiopian director also. But this film is really good. And I know that Italians, because this history was not in Italian textbooks, it's not a story that is. This history is starting to become known, but it hasn't been readily available for generations. I think that is changing now. But I think if there's ever a time to really begin to talk about this, it feels very urgent to do it here, but also to do it in Italy with the rise of the right wing that's there, that we have to remind ourselves that there were people fighting against fascism, you know, for a very long time. I think of Ethiopians as some of the original Antifa. But If Only I Were That Warrior would be a good one. Yes.
Um,
It was in my research, and I couldn't figure, it didn't work into the, it wasn't in the book. I'm glad you brought that up, though, because 1935, New York City, was almost, for me, I consider it a proxy war between fascism and this African nation that was free. The African American community in Harlem was out in the streets, marching, doing fundraisers, protesting what Mussolini was doing and the invasion. And so you have this, but here's another thing. At some point, I said, I started looking at the Amsterdam News. I started looking at old police reports from 1935, 36. And what I started noticing was that in the police reports, you would have Mr. So-and-so from Harlem gets in a fist fight with so-and-so from Brooklyn. And I'm like, I know what that was about, because it's an Italian and it's an African-American man. You know, and there were accounts of these again and again and again. I remember there was one where in New Jersey, there was a little boy, African-American boy, who I guess his parents thought he had run away, and then the police caught him. He had 12 cents in his hand. And the police said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to Ethiopia to give this to Haile Selassie." You know, so you had these stories. One of the albums I have, though, and this is, and I'm going to be putting this, is I could not figure this out for the longest time, but it looked to me like an album, I like some of my other albums, of these Italian soldiers in Ethiopia. But then the albums, the pictures you could slide out. So I slid out a few and I started looking on the back, and it said, "Joe somebody from New Jersey." Then it was another thing said, you know, "Carlo whatever from Brooklyn." I said, and this was my first clue that Italians had gone to fight for Mussolini, that there was a contingent, an American, Italian-American, and in fact, Mussolini opened the door for all Italians to come. So the African-Americans were restricted from leaving to fight. But they were raising funds, and for me, that level of generosity and, my God, just kindness, because sometimes these were people who didn't necessarily have enough money, what is extremely moving to me. So I think that's an important history. It's something I'm working on. It just didn't work into the book. But thank you. Yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, you have these two communities living, you know, across the hall next door and the buildings next door before they raise tenements. So there was already that tension that existed in the streets.
Yeah.
And over time, in New York, way before you get to
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
From just browsing through.
Yeah.
And looking at
those. It's something that James Baldwin mentions, and it's that Raoul Peck's documentary, "I Am Not Your Negro." There's a moment where James Baldwin talks about seeing a newsreel of Haile Selassie and this, you know, the fighters charging on a hill, and it gave him a sense of pride as this little boy in Harlem. And you're right, it's known within certain communities in the U.S., but
it wasn't always in the front on the front pages of, let's say, the New York Times. It was for a while, and I've been keeping track of that in 1935 through 36. But once Italy declared victory, even though Ethiopia had never surrendered, it was out of the minds of people, and Hitler came in, Mussolini formed an alliance, and everything suddenly had shifted to what was in Europe. Yes?
Was it, I know a lot of Americans went to fight against Franco.
Yes, the Spanish, yes.
How could they stop people from going?
I heard that there were people trying to enlist, and I'm not quite sure, but there were African Americans who went to the Spanish Civil War. In fact, I need to do more research on this, but there were Ethiopians who then moved. It was, became a, as another fight against fascism. So the Spanish Civil War was a whole other thing. I've just today, in fact, been in contact with a researcher around that period because I'm fascinated by that as well. Yeah, thank you. Yes. Thank you.
I cannot add to your literary style, artistic style. It's just amazing beyond what's already.
Thank you.
Mentioned here in your searches. But my interest is just more than just passing interest in this one. I think you're very much fascinated. And for sure, I think you've done a tremendous tribute to the Ethiopian women for their share.
Yes.
Also, if you've done any attempts to approach the Vatican, also, which I also played quite a dominant role.
Yeah. I wish I did. I wish I could. I did not approach the Vatican. I don't know how to do that. I don't know.
No,
I mean, if I could, I would have some questions for them. Yes, the Vatican, the role of the Vatican is something, I mean, even within Italy, it has to contend with, and it is, it's had to answer for some of that. But in terms of speaking to anti-fascists, I did get an opportunity to speak with descendants of them, and it was always interesting. There were some people who became anti-fascist once they were in Ethiopia and they understood what fascism was actually doing to people. There were people who came back, and then there were some people who didn't just... were that way from the very beginning. There is a man that I have met here, his name is Nicola, and he's in the documentary that I mentioned, and he lives in New Jersey. And he's Italian-American, but his parents came here because his father refused to enlist to fight against Ethiopia. That feels like an anti-fascist move to me. And I've spoken to him, and his parents are still alive. You know, they're still, and they are very proud of the fact that, no, we were not going to do this. And I think there are more stories like that as well. But so the anti-fascist movement in Italy, when I look at it, it's what gives me hope for what's happening in Italy now. Because they're tough. Like the anti-fascists were, for me, it felt like they were sometimes fighting against these impossible odds. Yeah, and then I see your hand. Okay.
One last question I have is, how close is the story of the photographer to real life?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. So my photographer, Ettore, is an Italian Jew. And... I don't know somebody that went there like him, but I know that men had their cameras, and I know Italian Jews were enlisted in the military. But the question that I started to ask as I was researching this, and it happened ironically at this moment where I was in Turin, And I was at this museum, of resistance museum. So there was a museum that with every form of resistance against fascism, against this was the museum. And I was there and I started walking through it. And I started thinking about the racial segregation laws that were enacted in Ethiopia once Italy won the war. And then 1 year later, the anti-Semitic laws were in effect across Italy. And those laws removed Jewish people from public offices, from universities, from the military, from everything, really isolating them. And I started wondering, walking through that museum, wait a minute, there were people who were soldiers in Ethiopia. What happened to them? And I remember talking to somebody, someone who was head of an organization, a Jewish organization in Italy, and I said, do you see any connection here between the racial segregation laws that passed in Ethiopia? And those racial segregation laws were apartheid, 11 or 13 years before apartheid was legalized in South Africa. Ethiopia, the Italians had it first in Ethiopia. So I said, is there any connection between that and the anti-Semitic laws? And he said, absolutely not. And I said, I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong. These were the same people. They're the same people that are doing this. Why aren't we connecting this history? And I talked to a friend of mine who is Italian Jew. And he mentioned to me, oh, my uncle. He said, I'm so sorry, Maza, but my uncle was in the military, you know, in Libya. And I said, what happened to him? He said, well, you know, he got kicked out. So I said, you know, there's something here. What Italy was doing in East Africa in its colonies with the racial segregation laws is finding ways to perfect what would become the anti-Semitic laws across Italy and its colonies. And I wanted to have to contend with one day I am Italian, and I'm enforcing these racial segregation laws. And then the next day, I'm not Italian, and I'm in fact an enemy of Italy. And my character, Ettore, is one of those people, and he has to figure out what to do. Thank you for that. Yeah. Then I see. Thank you for that. I was in Trieste looking for that history. It's not there. It's in Gorizia. I went there. Yes, I wanted to see that the concentration camp also that was right outside of Trieste. But Gorizia is one of the places I am really interested in. So I'll talk to you afterwards. Thank you. Yes. Yeah.
And Fermi barely escaped.
Yes.
His own life.
Yes.
Through to Stockholm and then never came back.
Thank you. And in fact, one of the most celebrated military officers in Italy around that time was Jewish. And when he was given the orders to turn himself in, that he was, you know, he was no longer in the military, he killed himself rather than to do that. But yeah, it's, yes, thank you for that. I saw a hand here, and then I see one there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But it's also very, very, there's so many broad.
You're right. But radio was the way before television, you know, these announcements, pronouncements, speeches. Haile Selassie was giving radio speeches, but so was Mussolini. And I think Italy had jammed BBC London. And at some point in the late 30s across Italy, people either had to turn in their radios or their radio station was glued only to the one fascist station, so they couldn't look for any other. But there's a fantastic book by Alexander Stiele called Benevolence and Betrayal, Betrayal and Benevolence, where he talks about that, people having to turn in the radios or get them glued to a station. So the radio was a weapon as well. I saw another hand over here. That's okay. Go ahead, and then I'll. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, you're gonna get to the end of my book. There's an Italian word. For people, insabbiati, like the people grounded into the sand. And this is usually the people who stayed. And I always thought, you know what? Some of these were Jewish people that could just disappear. I started looking at some of the histories, like the synagogues in Eritrea, and I was wondering, I was talking to some researchers trying to figure out, did people just stay? And he said, yeah, there's no way you could control everything. And of course, yeah, they became some of those people that literally just disappeared. So my sense is yes, I think some happened, like it had to have. But maybe because some people couldn't also imagine how bad it would be, might have just gone home. Yeah, but I don't know the numbers. Did I see another hand here that I'm missing? Okay, yes.
Well, I mean, first of all, there's the lost tribe, you know, the Ethiopian Jews, the Falashas.
Beta Israel. Uh-huh.
Israel. And they were just living in a very primitive way that they were doing the rituals. But I'm wondering about the numbers. What was the population of Ethiopia?
The population of Ethiopia? I'm not quite sure. Well, when they invaded with more than 100,000 men, and then more were coming. What Mussolini said was he was there to avenge Italy's loss from 40 years ago the first time, and he was not going to make a mistake and not have enough weapons or enough tanks or enough poison or enough men. And so he threw everything at Ethiopia. So there were, the number for the invasion was about 100,000, but there were many more that were coming. There were shiploads that were coming. I don't remember.
When I was a young student, I remember that we studied, of course, the fascism and the propaganda was for Mussolini. Even the United States, our Italian Culture Institute in the United States were invented by Mussolini. So it's completely another story for us. And I even know in my own families that they were fascists, but they didn't know what that means. Mm.
in Naples, around Naples, and he built in these big cities. And everybody knew that Mussolini was a sort of, before, of course, the life of Hitler, was a great man. And still today, there are, unfortunately, political movements that support that idea. But the problem here is how we can inform the new generation about all this story. This is, in your opinion, one question, what do you think about this? And the second, what about the young Ethiopians? What they know if they are studying a different history and how they reacted to that?
Yeah, thank you. I think in Italy, to answer your first question about how can more Italians know about this, I think it's starting to happen because you have a generation of Italians who are descendants from people in Ethiopia, in Eritrea, in Somalia, in Libya, and they know some of this history, and they're starting to write about it. Ijaba Shago is one of the writers. Gabriella Germandi, half Ethiopian, half Italian. There are Christina Ubah Ali, a Somali Italian writer. They are telling some of these stories in their writing in Italian. But what is interesting to me is when I go back to Ethiopia and I start talking to young people in Ethiopia, and by young, I guess I mean anywhere from 40, 50 to 20. And I start talking to them about this and about some of my research, what they tell me is we know nothing. We only know a few stories, but are you sure the Italians were really bad to us? You know, so these, I think there's two things that the cause of that. Number one is in 1941, when Haile Selassie came back to Ethiopia, he said, we need to forgive all of these Italians. What Mussolini did was wrong, but we need to treat Italians like our brothers. And then, so then you have Italians, the very same ones, I'm sorry to say, that were shooting at people who look like me are now marrying people who look like me and having families, and they don't talk about it. Then there's also just the very specific trauma of war and who wants to talk about their time in a prison or being interrogated or the battles. You know, we know now post-traumatic stress syndrome or the consequences of war, but we don't have those conversations in Ethiopia about what you carry with you once you leave the battlefield. And then you have the other layer of what happened to the women in war, where the women were both trophies and contested territory. They were to be conquered and fought, and then whatever they were, became the mothers of some children or they became the maids of Italians. And this history becomes so complicated because suddenly you have someone in your family who looks like the person who was cruel to you. And this conversation hasn't quite happened. And I haven't even talked about all of the really cruel things that happened. Nobody wanted to talk about it. Once it was over, Ethiopia won, we have a country, let's move on. But this history is still there. Did I see? Oh, are we? Maybe one more question? Okay.
Thank you for the information.
Thank you. Either one. So let me, Okay, let me just say this. Okay, so there's a secret part of my project, but I will announce it now because one of the things is even people who were involved in it, I would really like, but I'm also starting, it's a separate page of these photographs, and I'm calling it right now Memories Without Faces, because I know that Ethiopians and East Africans had very little access to photographs. So if there are stories to share from this, then I will be collecting those as well so that we still have a wall of those stories. So I would thank you. Thank you. All right. Oh.